time here at radio stations KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, and KFCF in Fresno is 7 o'clock, and you're listening to a special edition of Africa Today and Transitions on Traditions, honoring the life of Field Marshal Don Cox and Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt. Stay tuned. Good evening and welcome to a special edition of Africa Today on Transitions on Traditions, honoring the life of Field Marshal Don Cox of the Black Panther Party and honoring the life of Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt. We'll be here with you until 10 p.m. We have a number of audio clips of Geronimo and D.C. We have some special guests in the studio. One of the special guests we have is Emory Douglas. Emory Douglas, welcome to this evening's program.
A pleasure to be here.
Good, good. And tell us something about, just briefly, about yourself and about the two people we're honoring this evening.
Well, my name is Emory Douglas. I was involved with the Black Panther Party about 3 months into it, January 1967. Became the revolutionary artist, and then later on became the Minister of Culture. Later on, latter part of 1967, and worked on the Black Panther newspaper and many of the other cultural activities and whatever else was required of me at that particular time.
Okay, and you knew D.C. and Geronimo?
Yes, I knew D.C. well. Matter of fact, I used to see D.C. and didn't know who he was when he was in Corps. And what happened, we had a rally in San Francisco, and had these slips where we were trying to get people to sign up who had these skills to help people in this various areas of the party. And after that rally, when Bobby Seale had spoken, he came up to me and said his name was D.C., and that he was a printer, and that he could help out because he was during that rally. It had been mentioned that we need help with the paper and stuff like that, and I was there, and they could come talk to me. And so he offered his skills and services. And so maybe a couple of weeks after that, we need some assistance, and I did give him a call, and he said that he would be glad to help. And he worked downtown in the financial district in the plush printing area. Yeah, I mean, he was off down there by Samson and in that area, off the market, one of them high plush printing operations. And he had the keys, he ran the whole shop. And so it was midnight, we would go in there at night, and he would do all the pre-press stuff that we had asked of him for our newspaper. And so that went on for a while. And it was thereafter that he said he wanted to meet Huey. And I have a car at that time, so we caught the bus and we went over and introduced him to Huey, went to Huey's house and introduced him to Huey. And it was thereafter that he decided that he didn't want to do that anymore. He wanted to actually join the Black Panther Party.
Okay, we're also joined in the studio by Greg Bridges. Greg Bridges is your regular host of Transitions on Tradition, which comes on every Monday evening between 8 and 10 p.m. You hear him often here on other segments on Hard Knock Radio, morning programs, etc. Greg, this is a special program this evening.
These are two special people we're talking about, man, and some very special work that they've been doing for community, for the liberation of oppressed people. So it seems fitting that we do a show honoring these two soldiers and warriors.
And you selected the track we listened to this evening, which was a track from...
From Gil Scott-Heron, another brother who contributed so much to our culture and recently transitioned himself. The track I selected was called Must Be Something, because in thinking about the work that DC and that Geronimo and that the Panthers did overall, you know, that work was done with the thought that there must be something that we can do. You know, our ancestors didn't come all this way to give up or for us to give up, didn't make the sacrifices that they made for us to just turn our back on, you know, what was here before us. And that song, to me, speaks to what DC and what Geronimo meant.
And we also have one of the key people in the studio we want to thank for assistance with production. We want to thank Claude Marks of the Freedom Archives. We also want to thank Michael Yoshida here at KPFA. Let's listen to a short bio of D.C., Don Cox. Donald Lee Cox, best known as D.C., was the field marshal of the Black Panther Party from 1967 to 1971. D.C. was born in Appleton City, Missouri on April 16, 1936, made his transition on February 19, 2011. After an upbringing in Western Missouri, D.C. moved to San Francisco at the age of 17. He became involved in the civil rights movement and the black liberation struggles through his work with the Congress of Racial Equality and his growing awareness of the importance of the civil rights movement. D.C. cited the Birmingham, Alabama bombing and the death of four young girls as a turning point in his political consciousness. His time was spent listening to the voices of Malcolm X, Donald Warden, and the Nation of Islam. In the late 1960s, D.C. joined the Oakland, California-based Black Panther Party and became a member of the Central Committee. D.C.'s responsibilities included ensuring the military and political readiness of Black Panther Party members and their communities. With the escalation of FBI activity directed at the Black Panther Party, D.C.'s role took on both national and international dimensions. In the midst of the FBI's manipulations against himself and the party, D.C. was forced into exile and became part of the leadership of the international branch of the Black Panther Party, which opened in 1970 in Algeria. The work of D.C. and others in the international branch of the Black Panther Party was crucial to placing the Black Panther Party in touch with freedom fighters from throughout Africa and the world. There, the party was able to be in communication with members of the Palestinian Liberation Organizations, the PAIGC from Guinea-Bissau, the MPLA from Angola, and revolutionaries from China, South Africa, Vietnam, Mozambique, and Korea. In the late 1970s, D.C. left Algeria and resettled in France, eventually residing in southern France. Field Marshal D.C. of the Black Panther Party spent the greater part of his last 40 years in exile, separated from his friends and his family, his wife Barbara, his daughter Kimberly, and his sons Donald and Jonathan. He was an avid reader, a gardener, and had built himself a life in exile, away from the reality of his lifelong imprisonment if he returned to the United States. D.C. made his transition quietly on February 19, 2011 in southern France. We honor D.C. in the tradition of those who have fought and are fighting and sacrificing on the front lines to protect our communities and advance our humanity. Ashe. Billy Jennings was a member of the Black Panther Party from 1968 to 1974. He worked out of the national office of the Black Panther Party and worked with Huey Newton in the early 1970s, later running the campaign of Bobby Seale during his run for mayor. Billy was a founder of the It's About Time BPP Collective, Black Panther Party Collective, and maintains an outstanding website entitled It's About Time, consisting of information, news, and historical documents on the Black Panther Party. When did you first meet Don Cox?
Well, I actually first met him around about 1969. On Wednesday night, we worked on a paper in San Francisco in the Fillmore District, and he was based out of the San Francisco office. And so I would see him over at the San Francisco office on Wednesday night when we worked on the Black Panther Party newspaper. I found out he was the field marshal of the party. He's the kind of guy that he's approachable. He's kind of a quiet, private person, but at the same time, he will engage you in conversation, you know. And it, especially if you're talking about political affairs or military affairs, he will engage and talk to you about those things. To me, he's one of my oldest mentors. He's a person that a person can look to in the party and know that person is a solid rock. He's a principal Black Panther Party member. He was an example to most of us. At that time, we were 17, 18, 19 years old, and at that time, D.C. was in his 30s, you know. But he was an example for us young Panthers who was coming up in the ranks of the Black Panther Party.
What did that mean to have a field marshal in the Black Panther Party? How did you see that? What was the need for that?
Well, the field marshal part of the Black Panther Party, his duties and responsibilities were on a military basis. He may have to make sure all the officers of the Black Panther Party could protect yourselves, be it military weapons or sandbagging the officers, make sure that if there was a raid that people would survive, if their military weapons were operational, they had to make sure that people went to the range and carried out that military aspect of being responsible to the community. Because we viewed it like this in self-defense. You know, we would defend ourselves, we would defend where we live at, and that's what he enforced in the party.
When you heard about the passing, the transition of D.C., you were with Emory. What were your first reactions, both of you Black Panther Party members?
Well, my heart sunk. He was like one of the heart and soul members of the party. I mean, he was a person that you well respected. And when he passed, it was like, when I heard Barbara talking on the phone, it was like somebody punched me in my stomach, you know? Like my mother had died, like my cousin and my dad had died. And when I told Emory, he felt just as bad as I was. And I can tell by the expression that he had on his face that, hey, this is bad. It really hurt me because I went to visit D.C. some years ago, and, you know, he filled in some gaps in my information and knowledge of the Black Panther Party that I always wondered about, you know. Mm-hmm. And so he was the person I could look to give me a responsible answer to information I'm seeking.
When you visited D.C. in exile overseas in Europe, what were your impressions of D.C. in this phase of life and the reality of being in exile, but the reality of still being a revolutionary?
When I went to visit D.C., it was like going to see a brother who had boundless knowledge of the international struggle, but a humble person who gardened every day in his garden. And he would read constantly. You go to D.C.'s house, he has a wall full of books. I mean, he's a constant reader, always educating himself. And to go there, to be in his midst for a week or so, it was fantastic because it lifted me up and it gave me guidance to what I had to do in America. And so from that point, he said certain connections have to be made. And so what I've done is try to connect all the officers of the Black Panther Party, no matter when they were in the Black Panther Party, and put the history out for people to understand the history of the Black Panther Party through different phases of the struggle. If people have never heard of D.C., had never heard his words, go to our website. We have 4 or 5 video interviews with D.C. on our website. And also, in this year's our 45th year of the founding of the Black Panther Party, from 1966 to 2011. And in October, we're going to have some celebrations, and one of those celebrations is going to be for Donald Cox, and that's going to be in October 2011. So look for it on our website. We're going to be celebrating the life of Donald Cox, the Field Marshal of the Black Panther Party. He might be gone physically, but his spirit will always be with us.
Billy, thanks so much, and keep
all
up
right.
The good work.
All good people.
Take care.
All right.
My own personal desire is really more or less a regret is not having the intellectual capability to think of something that I personally could do that would be effective in raising the standard of living the survival of people all over the planet Earth. And my desire constant is to come up with an idea to something to do, you know. I've run across other people that seem to be in those kind of situations, but up until now, no one seems to have come up with an idea of anything concrete that we could do that would really be effective in bringing that about, you see. So I just could not live in a country like the United States and just not do anything. I wouldn't want to live as a fugitive because any work would have to be done on an open or legal basis. You know, the conditions don't exist in the United States for a completely clandestine struggle. So I could not just live there. So I've never had any problems about longing or regretting to not be able to go back or be home. I'm satisfied here. I'm anonymous. I can go around and do anything I want as long as I don't break the law. Nobody cares. And that suits me fine, you see. Because I don't want to attract any attention, you see. I don't want any attention.
That was the voice of Field Marshal Donald Cox, Donald Lee Cox of the Black Panther Party, speaking on his work abroad, on his life. Emory, when I saw DC's voice come on, you smiled. What crossed your mind there?
Well, many things crossed my mind. One is that I recall, matter of fact, we traveled that was my last trip to Algeria. And we were there together. And it was at that point that he said that he wasn't coming back because he had got word that that if he came back, he would be arrested and what have you. So he decided that he wasn't going back. But also I was smiling because I recalled the time when Billy was talking about the technical training. I recall out in, me and DC, we went out to North Richmond and we should go to the dump. And the nasty, filthy dump and do target practicing. And the authorities would come and they would tell us that we couldn't practice there. They didn't arrest us. So we weren't violating the law, but it was a city ordinance that we couldn't practice there. And so we used to go over to Marin, up in the Marin County, up in the hills, and do the same thing. And he was educating young people about their technical skills and what have you during that period. And the same thing, authorities would come. And they would say that you can't do that here. But it wasn't like we got arrested because we wasn't in violation of the law. It was just a violation of an ordinance during that period. And a lot of the pictures that you would see in the Perker Jones book, 1968, where it looked like Panthers and men and women were posing with the technical equipment in their hand. Well, those were actual in-between shots when Perker Jones came up there and took photographs when people were practicing and training and educating himself in self-defense and what have you. Also, I thought back to D.C. It was a group, a young African-American who lived in South Park, which people didn't know too much about South Park.
Where is South Park?
South Park is in San Francisco between 2nd and 3rd, between Bryant and Brannan. Hmm. It's a little area, and it's got a round circular area, and you got houses around that little park within there. And that D.C. was organizing there when he came into the Black Panther Party. And a lot of those young people from that area who were part of his cadre came into the Black Panther Party with him during that time.
Okay. What did it mean to be the minister of culture of the Black Panther Party, Emory?
Well, that was a title that came about in relationship to the work and responsibility that I had to do at that time, procurement of entertainment, trying to reflect in the artwork the politics of what the party was about in the images and the artwork, and the and trying to inspire in relationship to those who also were involved in doing some type of artwork of things that dealt with something of substance of consciousness, and trying to inspire them to be able to not duplicate what I was doing, but to be used their own creativity in relationship to adding to the what we were already standard that we were setting during that time.
Good, you're very modest, Henry. But we'll talk later more about some of your artwork and some of the other things that you've done. We're going to give a listen to someone else who mentions that you played a role in the Black Panther Party. We're going to give a listen to the voice of Barbara Cox, the wife of DC. Barbara began her work with the party in the late 1960s and served in various offices both nationally and internationally. She's continued her work back in Philadelphia around issues of housing, around issues of political prisoner. Barbara, thank you so much for making time.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
It's a total honor. When did you first meet your husband, Don Cox? When did you meet Don?
I met Don in the latter part of 1967. Emery introduced us.
What attracted you to him and what attracted him to you?
I can't say I was attracted to him right away, but I was taken by his pleasantness. And after about a month or so of conversations, he asked me would I go with him to the Black Power Conference in Los Angeles. And I said, okay. And that's when I really got a chance to see who this man was.
What about who this man was made this someone that, you know, you certainly worked together within the party and with your husband, children together, etc.? Some people look at Don and they say he was soft-spoken, and some people say, no, he wasn't soft-spoken. Mm-hmm. He chose his time to speak. What was it about his personality that you could share with us?
Well, I could say his commitment to the struggle and his insights into what needed to be done. He didn't reveal to me right away that he was on the Central Committee or that he was the field marshal. But in conversations about his personal life history, he had belonged to CORD, SNCC, NAACP, you know, things of this nature. I could see someone who had a desire to be involved with the Black Panther Party. As you know, I was involved with Black students, but the party was new to me, and the information and the insight he gave me made me say, let me stick with this person. So, you know, love, commitment, okay, all of that develops over a period of time. So within 6 months to a year, I knew this was a person that I wanted to be around.
That's a nice story, Barbara.
It's the truth.
I know. It's a really nice story.
Okay.
The period of the Black Panther Party, what was it like in those early days working with Don and doing the organizing here in San Francisco?
Well, what was interesting, I myself was an older person. And not as old as Don, but, you know, older than many of the recruits. And I brought my experience, I would say my morals, I would say organizational thoughts to whatever I got involved with. I started out working for Kathleen and Eldridge at their house. And that led me to go to the Panther office on Fillmore Street, where I would work with Sam Napier in organizing the distribution of the newspaper. And I did that approximately a year or so before the New York 21 big bus in New York, in which time, soon, a couple months after that, I came to New York to work. So I see myself as a person that worked with the rank and file, and I loved that work. I loved the breakfast program. I loved the political education classes, the distribution of the paper. And basically, I did the same work that anyone else did because I respected that he was the person of importance in our relationship. So I did whatever I could do to support the party and then support the field marshal.
What did it mean, Barbara, that he was the field marshal? What's the significance in that in terms of the party at that moment? What level of responsibilities and weight did that title and job carry?
I knew he had to travel a lot. But I didn't always look to go with him, but entertaining people from out of town, like Stokely, whenever Stokely would come in town, Don would always be with him, or Foreman. I was always sort of in the background, and that was fine. So you support the party, and you support your man. So his responsibilities really became clear after the New York 21, 68, 69, outside of just to travel, then he became that person who would go to the new chapters, investigate, interview, set up, approve. And as far as the military aspect of being a field marshal, that was, for him, an easy part because he had grown up in the country, back in Missouri. I mean, guns were second nature to him. But what I did like was always the responsibility of teaching people it is not a toy and it is not something you just go out and show and boast. It's the second part of being a field marshal. The first part is organization. Mm-hmm. And he did not feel that everyone needed a gun. But you did need organizational skills, the ability to talk about the party, and a world, not just Oakland, Frisco, New York. No, you had to learn. He was really into educating people about the world. I feel that he had a very responsible position, and he carried it out very well. He was a people person, and after his death, I mean, the emails that I got from around the world showed me that the diversity of this man.
How tense was that period there where COINTELPRO was active, the FBI was active, there was subterfuge and infiltration and every attempt to destroy the party? How difficult is that phase from someone like yourself who lived it, Barbara?
Once he went into exile and I joined him in 70, I think it was then that I saw the, and we did not know it was COINTELPRO at all of that. I mean, we knew that they had become personal with us in terms of people joining the party, undercover agents. We were aware of that, but it wasn't until exile that you really could see and feel some of the subterfuge, is the word, that was going on. That was difficult because you're so far away. And then also, if I'm permitted to say, after the split in 71, it became increasingly difficult for those of us who were living abroad, so to speak, because we didn't have firsthand information. And in retrospect, because you have to look back now, we see the damage that COINTELPRO did. But it was difficult being away from family, friends, and immediate sources of information.
The reality, you said in one of the memos you sent out that isolation was very, very hard. It was taking a toll. And I'm wondering, you also raised children, too. How do you do that, Barbara?
We weren't as fortunate as Elbridge and Kathleen to keep our son with us. And we sent our son back to America for what we thought would be 30 days. But it turned into a year before I could come back. I remember I wanted to go to work in Germany because by that time, you remember Elvidge's income had been held up by the feds. And I volunteered to go to work in Germany. And he was very upset that he had to lose his family. He said, I always have to sacrifice. And it was hard. But, so we really didn't raise our son overseas. And that was in 1972. It's difficult. I remember Pete and Charlotte. They moved to Tanzania. Gwen Achille, her daughter, came back to America, and several persons in exile. So when you have young children and you don't have a real financial support system, it is difficult and it's hard on you.
What were some of the things that were being done at the international section of the Black Panther Party?
Elvidge was always trying to make contacts with other liberation groups. And Kathleen was his interpreter. Myself and Don was also the person that Elvidge counted on the most because he was an equal. I'm going to put it like that. So they were always out together doing things, setting things up, whereas myself, I would always visit the women of the liberation groups. And that was very rewarding because I would always come back with more information than they got.
Okay. Okay.
Because women gather in kitchens, and I would gather with the women. And I still have friends to this day from some of those liberation groups.
Now, at some point, Don left Algeria, and he moved to where he made his transition. He moved in France, and I was reading stories that Don was a gardener, he grew flowers. Talk about Don and his life in exile, the difficulties and the bright moments.
Well, I think the difficulties, one of them was you didn't have your passport. You didn't have working papers. But when he first moved to France, within a period of, with the help of friends, I think in the period of a year, he was able to secure working papers. 2 years, he actually got his American passport. He met many people. Pele, the Nigerian musician, also Public Enemy came over. And because he was an American and it was the early 70s, Black Panther was still a novelty, all right? But then France started trying to export foreigners, particularly Africans. And unless you had working papers, and of course there was the whole idea of if you were black, that meant you were some sort of African, and you weren't going to be hired. And that's when he made a transition down to southern France, where he built his home, and he involved himself with women's groups. He studied gardening, so he grew his own food. He was also excellent at astronomy, aromatherapy, and the French slave trade. He did a really good study on that. Mm-hmm. And all three of those things kept him busy for, I would say, just up until the last 7 or 8 years. And then he just focused on his immediate environment. But he was very broad-based, and when I was there in March, I was looking at all the 500 books he has in his library, and I'm like, help!
Okay.
But he was very broad-based in terms of his interests. And the man developed to the point of, I always thought of him as an international kind of person, but now I think of him as a universal kind of man.
In our last moment here, I'm going to put two questions together. One, share with us something about D.C. that we wouldn't know any other way. The other thing is, share something with us about what do we as communities of people, activists, people for black liberation, human liberation, what do we do to make sure that people such as Don Cox and Michael Setuweo Tabor and others don't find themselves in exile forever with some degree of isolation?
The first thing I would say is continue education. And I don't mean formal education. I mean reading, discussions, broaden your base from a local locality to a national and international concepts of people in general. And study history. If you go to a country, study the history before you go. Because that was one thing he taught me. And I really appreciate that. Every time I would go visit with him, it was like a political education class. I want you to read this. I want you to watch that. He was always informing people of new ideas, new things. He wasn't a complainer. I do think, like many of us, in hindsight, he surely have looked back on, well, I wish I hadn't done that, a few times I would bring up certain things to him, and he would go, I don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
Because I was ready to go stick my hand in the wound.
Okay.
I think towards the end, he had a kindness, just a kindness for people. But if you made him angry, you would have to pay. But he, like anyone else, if you have time on your hands, you grow and develop. And that's what he did. That's what he did. So there are enough stories of that beautiful brother, Don Cox, out there. And I encourage people to read them and to study them. And if any way I can ever help them, call me.
Barbara, thank you so much. We feel honored here at the radio station to be able to talk about someone like Don Cox, who, as many said, was a legend, but who was a person, a family man, a husband, and just somebody who we really cherish. So, And most modest.
Yes.
Barbara, take the best of care of yourself. If you want to talk to us, we're always here, okay?
Thank you, Walt.
Total Please. Pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The States in 1970, in May, I worked until the inevitable repression struck against me. Fortunately for me, I got a little 2 weeks warning, so that gave me a chance to get my shit together and manage to escape before they were able to capture me, you see. There was a case in Baltimore of a conspiracy to assassinate a police informer, and I was at the head of the list. My situation with the United States, it more or less could be considered, it was at a state of war, you see. So when I left, I left, you see. And my life belonged to the struggle, you see. I didn't exist for me, you know. Of course, I had my own personal thoughts and whatnot, but I was a disciplined soldier, you see. So I put all my personal desires aside. I didn't exist for myself. So I continue the loot. I continue the struggle by leaving, because I went to Algiers and joined with Eldridge Cleaver, Sekou Odinga, and Larry Mack. We organized the international section of the Black Panther Party in Algiers. Our dream, I think, of most of us at one time or another, was for a revolution in society to correct the ills and provide everybody with a good life.
Field Marshal of the Black Panther Party. He initially began his work in the San Francisco Bay Area and eventually became responsible for the political and military readiness of the Black Panthers in many of communities throughout the United States. D.C., as he was referred to, was a member of the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party between 1967 and 1971. As the party became actively targeted by the FBI COINTELPRO program and ravaged by internal conflict, D.C. was falsely accused of a felony attack on a Black Panther and sought exile in the country of Algeria. There he served in the international branch of the Black Panther Party until he relocated to France, where he stayed in exile until his transition in March of 2011. Don Cox is talked about in superlative terms as a father, a daddy, a hard worker, a leader, a member of the Black Panther Party, and a contributor to the movement for Black liberation. We are joined on the phone by Kimberly Ruth Vaughn Cox Marshall, the daughter of Don Cox. Kimberly, thanks so much for making the time to talk about your father. He was so well known. His name has been mentioned so much, but we wanted to talk with one of the children, and I'm so glad to be able to reach you.
Well, I really appreciate you doing this. He would really, really like this.
Good. When I asked you the other day how you'd like to be introduced, you said Kimberly Ruth Vaughn Cox Marshall, and you said you had a little smile symbol, and you said there's a story behind that.
Well, yes. My mother wanted to name me Scheherazade. Thank God my dad stepped in and named me Kimberly. So I always love that story, because he said there was no way he was going to call me Scheherazade. And they named me Ruth after my godmother, and Vaughn, that was my mother's maiden name. Family was very important to both my mother and father, and they always made sure we knew where we came from. And, of course, Cox, my maiden name, and Marshall's my married name.
You know, when I spoke with you and probably about a month or so ago, and I reached you and you reached back to me, and I said, you know, we're going to do this program, and you said, not only did you say you wanted to be involved, you said you were eager to be involved. Why Kimberly?
Well, in my dad's passing, I read so many things about the Panther Party and things like that, but I didn't see anywhere where someone was talking about the man, my daddy. And I said, wow, for you to ask me to participate, I was just so happy that finally I would get to tell another side that a lot of people didn't see.
When you think about daddy and you think about the social consciousness he had, the community kind of perspective he had, talk about those memories, because there's certainly a daddy with a consciousness before the Black Panther Party.
Oh, yes. One of the first memories I have as a young child, we marched on Market Street. It was for CORE, and there are some pictures, and he was looking for something, and that was the beginning I could see as time progressed.
How has that stuck with you, Kimberly, as you've gone through your years of having a family and doing all the things that make up a person as they get older and grown and responsible? How has that early part of daddy stuck with you?
Well, he stuck with his convictions. He left his family for something he believed in. Whether you think it's right or wrong, that's a big deal. You know, to leave like that. So it must have been something, well, it obviously was something that he very strongly believed in.
You know, when I was listening to an audio piece of your father talking as I was driving up to the studio, and other people I spoke to said, and he always had that impression of looking quiet and somebody was soft-spoken, but then other people said, well, no, he could get his point across. Talk to us about daddy's demeanor, Kimberly.
When I hear that, I'm like, wow, because I guess I talked so much when I was little. He used to say, look, I'll give you a nickel if you just be quiet for a minute.
Okay.
But he was just, to me, there was just so much there. The things that he would do, I was just always inquisitive on why. And that was, you know, one thing he would just say, oh, Lord, okay, give me a minute, let me breathe first. But when he said something, I think then, too, you listened. Because he wasn't always talking. So when he had something to say, I definitely listened.
Where was Daddy from? He was from Missouri.
Missouri. Appleton, Missouri.
And Appleton is a small, small town, is it not?
Oh, yes. And he grew up, I believe, his formative years in a town called Sedalia. Very small town.
Okay. And it must not have been a large Black community back there.
No, not, but, you know, his grandmother that sort of raised him, she was Swedish.
Did you meet DC's mom and dad?
Well, I knew his dad. His mom had passed by then. We went to Missouri, hit one of his sports cars, his green Mustang.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah, him and his cars. Yeah, we went back, visited his dad and the rest of the family. It's strange. I always said, being a child of divorced parents, you're usually not that close to the father's side, but I'm very close to that side of the family. Very close.
Okay. You're telling us something now we didn't know. You're talking about the green Mustang. Was Daddy in the cars?
Oh, yes. Daddy raced at Sears Point.
Oh, no.
Oh, Daddy had Austin Healey's Triumphs. Oh, the blue GTO. I know many people know about that blue GTO. He loved fast cars.
Okay, so at some point when he got into the party, he let some of the car thing go, or no?
Oh, yeah. He had to. He had the GTO in the beginning. That's what he was going to Reno with to get those guns, and my mother had to take that back.
Oh, she tried to take the GTO back.
Oh, she had to, because, you know, hey, that was, that's when they were separated, and, you know, here the FBI surrounding the car when, you know, her and her two little babies are coming home, and she's, like, wondering, well, who are you guys, you know? But we knew what was going on. But the car got too hot, so he just let Mama go ahead and just take that.
Was Daddy a printer at some point? Is that what he was doing?
He was a photographer. He worked for Stover and Company on Spear Street in San Francisco. And it was an advertising agency, and that's how he got his start. He was there, and he took up photography. Like I said, he was amazing to me because he could pick up anything and run with it.
Mm-hmm. Talk about some of the other things that he loved, Kimberly.
He would make model airplanes, wooden airplanes, but I'm talking like they would be like 3 feet. And he would fly those in Golden Gate Park. The cars, when he got to Paris in the south of France, he redid the place that he was living in. It was a barn. He just turned it into a home, and with no experience or anything, and he loved to show me. I was able to go see him in October, and how everything was level. And I said, well, Daddy, people just don't do this. I said, you know, but he's like, well, all you just have to do is just want it. And I said, well, it doesn't work that way with everyone. But he also was raising bees for their honey for a while until he got stung by a bee and didn't know he was allergic. And he had to stop that. But he would just pick up things. He had a garden there. He was really into his gardening. And he would just want to do something. He would go do it and just run with it.
Well, I can hear in your voice that Daddy is just totally special.
Oh, I'm a total daddy's girl, and don't care who knows it.
Okay, and there's this period when it gets very difficult, and Daddy has to leave the country. It's during the years where I think he says that the party is in turmoil. How do you weather that, Kimberly, knowing that the level of danger that's out there, the FBI program, the internal stuff? How do you, as a daughter, weather that?
You know, it wasn't that we were shielded, but it didn't really affect us that much. The thing that really affected us, because when he left, there was a period, there were years, none of the family knew where he was. And I believe it was 74, we finally realized he was in Algiers on his way to France, I believe, or something like that. Okay. But that was the hard part, not knowing where he was. I always had faith in him. That's weird to say, but I never worried about him. But when we didn't hear from him or didn't know whether he was dead or alive, that was the hard part. But I had the support of my mother and my grandmother. My great-grandmother didn't pass till I was in my second year of college. I had my grandfather and my brother, so we had a nice unit there.
When you would read something about Daddy, or you would, when the party was in trouble, and you would hear that, well, this is a faction and that's a faction, and who knows the process of, because this is your daddy. How do you? Most of us won't have this experience, Kimberly. How do you deal with that?
The only way I can say really is just, I went to Lutheran school, and I must have been in the seventh grade. And we had to read Reader's Digest. And here I am, we're all reading Reader's Digest, and it's a story about the Black Panther Party and about how my daddy's teaching these young kids how to make fire bombs to go kill people. That didn't trip me out. I was more excited that, hey, there's my daddy in Reader's Digest.
Okay.
You know, and I'm jumping up and down and saying, hey, this is my daddy. And I'm, like I said, I'm in a Lutheran school. And they're looking at me like, oh, my God. And you sent me that question. I was like, wow, I never really tripped on it. It was always just, that's my daddy, that's life, that's how things are. And like I said, I always had faith in him.
Did you ever have a chance to visit him in Algeria?
No, I visited him in Paris in 84. He and his ex-wife there. And I was able to go last year, October. I just am so glad I was able to do that. I really, really would have hurt my heart if I wouldn't have been able to see him before he left. So that was really cool that I got to do that.
And what did you talk about when you were there? You mentioned some of it. What did you and Daddy talk about? How much time did you get to spend with him, Kimberly?
About a week, and he still treated me like his little girl. I had to sit between his legs so he could do my hair.
Oh, he was braiding your hair?
Oh, yeah. He combed and brushed my hair because that's what he did when I was little. I mean, he always saw me, and I guess, you know, and I played the role as his little girl. And I'm like, Daddy, you know, stop. And I'm like, okay, I'll just let him go ahead. He cooked for me. He wouldn't let me cook. He wouldn't let me do anything. He got to play daddy.
Do you have a chance to, for yourself, Kimberly, to interact with people who were in the political movement, the Black Panther Party? Or was it basically your contact with daddy and his role?
Just daddy. There were some because we had relatives, but not much. Like I said, you know, especially since at that time, that's when my parents had separated. So there was that disconnect there. But it was just more daddy a lot.
Okay. How was daddy doing when you saw him? He braided your hair, but how was he doing when he was in France? I mean, I spoke to you a couple people, and they said, well, you know, he was well. I mean, he laid down, he worked in the garden, and the next day he made his transition. How was daddy doing when you saw him?
He was older, of course, but he was just fine to me. You know, that's why it was such a shock for him to pass. I was just very lucky. I called him once a month, and I called him on that Tuesday. But I knew something was wrong with him. Just the things he was saying, we were all planning to go next year and see him so he could see my kids, and he had two great grandbabies, and I wanted him to see them, and my brother and his son and his wife. And he said once, he goes, I just hope I'm there. I don't know if I'll make it. And I'm like, Daddy, yes, you will. Just hang on. And that next day, I emailed my stepmother up in Paris, and I'm like, Francoise, give me your opinion. And I kind of knew something was wrong because she said she wanted to write it in French first and English. And if you knew her, for her to say that, that was a big deal. And she never got to because then he passed that Friday. So maybe he knew, but he was just trying to hang on, but he just couldn't hang on anymore.
Okay. And Kimberly, if I could ask, what area, what profession did you wind up taking up yourself?
Computers. I went into technology.
Okay. Was daddy into computers and electronic stuff?
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at a table I use in my office. He built a stereo, the kind with tubes.
Okay.
Yeah. Like I said, when he put his mind to it, he would do it. My mom still had it down in the garage. I kept asking my brother, I wonder if this thing works. But, oh, yeah. Yeah, that much. But computers, not so much because of where he was. They didn't even get phones in all the houses until the 90s. He was very much in the mountains.
You know, your father was so important, revered to everyone. I mean, when his transition came, it was all across the web. Was it feel like to have a daddy, a father who's an icon, not only to you, obviously, as you've talked about, but to so many other people around the world?
I was amazed. I really didn't know. You know, you get so sheltered in the area where you are and the people that surround you. When I started seeing all the emails and like I said, like you say, on the web, I felt so proud. And I just see him sitting there smiling, shaking his head, saying, right on, right on. I mean, that was his thing. And it was just so touching, to see the kids. You know, the young kids, that blew my mind. That was nice to see. That was nice to see.
Any words that cross in your mind you want to share? What has all of this meant to Kimberly? I mean, you know, as my friend always tells me, the ancestors don't make mistakes. They know what they're doing, and there's guidance always out there. What has all this meant to you?
Well, I lost him because of this. I had issues that I don't think I would have had if he would have been around. But like I said, I knew he was doing something for the greater good. But I was being selfish that, well, where was the good for my brother and I? You know, like I said, I didn't realize all this. And I'm hope that, you know, the people that he touched, they take something from him, because he was dedicated. That's what I admire. I might not have liked it, but he never turned his back on what he believed in. And that's, to me, to leave your family and everything else, that's a strong conviction, and he stuck to it. So I respect him for that. I just always wish that people would remember, you know, you go out here and you try to do things to change the world, but remember the people you leave behind. I really feel bad that my brother didn't get to know him as much as I did. That hurts a lot. And the families, his sisters, they really, really love their younger brother. And it hurts when you leave the family and, you know, you don't know where you are, or you can't, you know, give some words to a young man growing up that he might need to hear. I was very lucky. I got to tell him what I wanted to tell him. And I took off, you know, the rose-colored glasses and took him off that pedestal, and it was good. But we went from there, and we were able to go on. But a lot of people don't have that chance. And always remember to talk. It's important to talk.
Kimberly, I want to thank you so much for making the time, and especially for being being willing to talk. And it's just been great, and it's wonderful to be able to say something in honor of someone who we think so much about, Don Cox, D.C., a field marshal of the Black Panther Party, and most importantly, the daddy of Kimberly Ruth Vaughn Cox Marshall.
Thank you so much.
Total pleasure, Kimberly.
And moonshots and blame it on the have-nots. Money, we made it.
You're listening to radio stations KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno. You're listening to special programming this evening on the life and honoring the life of Don Cox, D.C., Field Marshal of Black Panther Party. Be talking later about Geronimo Gijaga Pratt, Elmer Pratt. Both of these are two freedom fighters who have made their transitions recently. And we're joined graciously in the studio by Emory Douglas, the Minister of Culture of the Black Panther Party. We're also joined in the studio by Greg Bridges. Greg Bridges is a regular host of Transitions on Traditions, which you hear every Monday evening on radio station KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno. That's 88.1 in Fresno. You can always give us a listen online. That's at www.kpfa.org. Greg, you were working on the program and reading around this program and doing some of the interviews and the part where we're going to be listening talk about Geronimo. What thoughts crossed your mind about this legacy of history, these voices of Don Cox and of Geronimo?
And first of all, it's an honor to be able to be involved in something like this, where I do get to take part in paying tribute to two members of a society that were heroes to me as a child. The Black Panther Party, growing up here in Oakland, meant a lot to my development as a youth. So being able to revisit the lives of Donald Cox and Geronimo Gijaga Pratt as Black Panther Party members was an honor, but it was an additional honor to be speaking with their family members, with the family members of Geronimo Pratt, with his sister Jenny and his daughter Shona, who we'll hear from later, and even hearing DC's daughter speak about him, you know, in the way that a daughter sees her father, hearing hearing Barbara speak about meeting and, you know, her life with DC, you know, it was an honor to be a part of bringing the human side of them to light for our listeners. As I mentioned time and again during these interviews, we got to know them as the freedom fighters that they were, as the revolutionists, as the community protectors that they were. And in their roles that way, we didn't get to see them as the family men. So hearing from their family members about that side of their lives, for me, was a big part of putting this together.
I want to thank one other person who's in the studio with us, Claude Marx. He's the director of Freedom Archives, and he, along with Michael Yoshida, who work here in engineering at KPFA, are responsible for doing the audio, editing the audio, and making this particular program possible. And we certainly want to thank the families of Geronimo Chijaga Pratt and the family of Don Cox and so many other people who we'll talk about later. Emory, what's going through your mind? This is, you've lived this history. This has been your history. What's going through your mind as you're hearing these voices?
Well, it just bring back fond memories of D.C. He was a kind person, very humble. It was a person that you was approachable and would listen to you and give you some wise insights and advice. And so when listening to everyone, the consensus comes together is that what I was thinking about. Not only that, the fact that his convictions is that he was determined in his convictions. I can give you a little anecdote. I remember one time coming into the San Francisco office, and there was this old guy. He was sitting down in the chair, and he had a long beard and gray hair and what have you. And I sit next to him for a good while. And he said, "You don't know who this is, huh?" And that was D.C. Hmm. He was the master of disguises.
But Emory, you know, thinking about both of these brothers at DC, yeah, and Geronimo in the family context, you yourself as a Panther had a family during that time. Speak on the challenges and the difficulties of being an activist while also, you know, as an activist.